caught up and I can't pay the rent. Oy, ay caramba. Please them stop, they say you look like wanted man. I said chance will be fine, they put cup up on me hand. The very next day they catch the dirty one. Say we won't keep you long, late you are tomorrow. Oy, ay caramba.
Yeah. que tiene ese territorio. Palmas hermosas, gran cafetales, piña sabrosa y panal de miel. Nunca pensé que podía encontrar tanta belleza en ese lugar. Se cuela, qué rico es. Yuca con ñame y carne de macho es su comida tradicional. Yuca con ñame y carne de macho es su comida tradicional.
Oye, con Taiwán me voy para las Yaguas. Oye, con Taiwán me voy para las Yaguas.
Slavic Community Hour is looking for new collective members. The Slavic Community Hour is an interactive news, talk, and music program focused on Portland's Ukrainian and Russian community. No experience is required, just an enthusiasm for Slavic culture and a desire to learn. If you speak Ukrainian or Russian and have an interest in community radio, please reach out to program@kbu.org to learn more. That's program@kbu.org.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County inmates may have had personal info shared illegally, Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort is raided by the FBI, and in international news, we look to the impacts of Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, August 9th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Staff at Multnomah County jails may have shared the personal information of hundreds of inmates improperly, according to a new report from OPB. The info was shared between September of 2019 and June of this year for around 350 people. It dealt with personal information like medical diagnoses tied to whether the person imprisoned was mentally fit enough to participate in their defense at trial. Data like names, photos, and diagnoses were shared with the health department, and officials couldn't confirm if there was a paper trail order for all of the information that was shared between these departments, meaning that the information may have been shared illegally. Those 350 people impacted received a letter letting them know that their data may have been shared improperly. County officials say the risk associated with the data transfer is low to moderate, but will offer folks impacted free identity theft protection services. The FBI searched former President Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort home on Monday under a search warrant related to handling of presidential documents, including classified documents. The search was conducted while Trump and his family were not at the resort, and Trump has said that the FBI opened his safe. In a statement Monday evening, Trump said, quote, "My beautiful home Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida is currently under siege, raided and occupied by a large group of FBI agents," end quote. A search warrant for the FBI requires a sign-off from a federal judge and a detailed list of what agents are looking for and where they expect to find it. The Justice Department has two open investigations related to Trump, one about the coordination to overturn the 2020 election on January 6th, and one about the mishandling of classified documents. The warrant and the search are a window into how serious the FBI and the Justice Department are handling these investigations. Experts agree that it's a big move to search the residence of a former president. Spokespeople for President Biden say he was unaware of the FBI raid until it was reported on the news. The National Archive has previously recovered 15 boxes of White House records from Mar-a-Lago earlier this year, including some that were classified. Republicans reacted immediately to the raid, including House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who said that if Republicans take back the House, he would launch an investigation into the Department of Justice's investigation. Pro-Trump protesters also rallied outside of the Mar-a-Lago resort on Monday evening, denouncing the FBI. Former President Donald Trump claims he's being politically persecuted after the FBI raids on his Mar-a-Lago home, and Ukraine will get $1 billion more in aid from the U.S. With more on these stories, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Never forget, everything this corrupt establishment is doing to me is all about preserving their power and control over the American people.
Former President Donald Trump says he's a victim of political persecution. He released a statement Monday saying the FBI executed a warrant on Mar-a-Lago, his residence in Palm Beach, Florida. The Justice Department is investigating Trump's actions regarding the January 6 attack at the U.S. Capitol as a House committee investigates Trump's efforts to overturn President Joe Biden's victory in the 2020 election. There's no word on what was taken, but there are reports the warrant focused on material Trump took home from the White House after leaving office. U.S. Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colin Kahl says the U.S. is sending an additional $1 billion in new military aid for Ukraine, including rockets and ammunition.
If we allow a big country to bully a smaller one, to simply invade it and take its territory, then it's going to be open season, not just in Europe, but around the world.
Russia is said to be moving troops and equipment in the direction of the southern port cities to stave off a Ukrainian counteroffensive. U.S. security assistance to Ukraine now totals more than $9 billion. President Biden and the First Lady visited eastern Kentucky Monday after historic flash floods devastated the area, killing at least 37 people. Biden increased federal assistance to help the state in its recovery and asserted politics have no place in disaster response.
When there's trouble, everybody jumps in. And I mean that's all the way from Mitch McConnell and I. We do battle all the time on issues, but Kentucky, when it comes to these issues, it's all one team.
Today, Biden will sign the CHIPS and Science Act into law, a $280 billion package aimed at encouraging domestic semiconductor manufacturing and strengthening supply chains.
We have a chip shortage today, and it's costing our economy, and it's increasing inflation. We know that there is going to be a chip demand that is going to be threefold from where we are today in the very near future.
That's Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington. The measure also invests in university research and technology development and STEM opportunities. In election news, Wisconsin's Republican gubernatorial primary features competing candidates endorsed by Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence. Democrats are picking a candidate to face two-term GOP Senator Ron Johnson, and Vermont voters are picking a replacement for Senator Patrick Leahy. U.S. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar of Minnesota faces a primary challenger who helped defeat a voter referendum to replace the Minneapolis Police Department with a new Department of Public Safety. On Monday, Nebraska's Republican Governor Pete Ricketts reversed his plan to call a special session of the state legislature to pass a 12-week abortion ban after failing to gather sufficient support from state senators. Current Nebraska law prohibits abortion starting at 20 weeks. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eTrust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
More people are losing their homes in Oregon or are at risk of it. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade breaks down the reasons why.
Eviction rates are rising in Oregon as resources for renters facing houselessness are diminishing. As rents continue to rise in the state, pandemic-era rental assistance and eviction protections have begun to dwindle. The situation has only worsened by investors snatching up real estate amid a COVID-depressed housing market. The greater demand for housing, coupled with minimal rent control options, is allowing landlords to hike up rent. In Portland, average rent for a one-bedroom apartment rose 34% last year. Currently, roughly half of all Oregon renters spent at least 30% of their income on rent, a statistic that places them below the federal standard for living affordability. During the height of COVID-19 shutdowns, eviction moratoriums were put in place, and Oregon Housing and Community Services dispersed nearly $400 million in emergency rental support. OHCS funding went to 60,829 households and helped keep at least 130,000 people in their homes. Once eviction protections were lifted, many households still faced owing back rent amid ongoing pandemic economic instability. In January 2022, 806 evictions were filed, while in the first half of July, there were over 630. Most of these filings were a result of non-payment. Experts, advocates, and policymakers have been predicting an eviction crisis that for many has seemed to arrive. Kim McCarty, executive director for the Community Alliance of Tenants, said, quote, "Eviction rates are steadily increasing, and there's every reason to believe that they will continue to go up," end quote. McCarty maintains the state is bracing for two significant spikes of evictions, one in October, when all emergency evictions expire, and the second in January, when landlords can increase rent. Tenants will also be facing a three-day notice of eviction versus the 10-day notice under Senate Bill 892, which is set to expire this fall. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
A more than $10,000 reward is now being offered for information on the killings of four Muslim men in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The most recent killing was Friday, just after the funeral for two of the victims. Police have identified a suspect in the case. Roz Brown has more.
Albuquerque has been thrown into the national spotlight after the ambush-like shootings of four Muslim men, three in the past 2 weeks, prompting President Joe Biden to express his outrage over what appear to be hate crimes. The nation's largest nonprofit Muslim civil rights group, the Council on American-Islamic Relations, is offering a $10,000 reward to anyone who can provide information leading to the arrest and conviction of those responsible for the killings. Ibrahim Hooper, the council's national communications director, says the first killing last November seemed random, but that's clearly not the case.
It's just unprecedented that you would have these attacks over now more than 9 month period. Always in these cases, somebody knows something, and they just need an incentive to come forward.
The most recent homicide occurred late Friday night. 25-year-old Naeem Hussein had been a U.S. citizen for less than a month when he was shot just hours after attending a funeral for two of the recent victims. Over the weekend, the Albuquerque police said a dark gray or silver four-door sedan with tinted windows, perhaps a Volkswagen, may be involved in the shootings. Albuquerque police officers have adjusted shifts and schedules to monitor the city's mosques and places of prayer in the Muslim community. Because the area doesn't have a large Muslim population, Hooper says the targeted killings have created significant fear.
We're working with law enforcement authorities, we're working with the local Muslim community, and just trying to get through this horrific series of events, and hopefully it can prevent anything from occurring in the future.
Albuquerque already has recorded 75 homicides this year, a comparable number to 2021, which was the city's deadliest year on record. This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
The U.S. Senate passed the Inflation Reduction Act over the weekend, and it includes provisions that could reduce drug prices for people on Medicaid. The bill now goes to a vote in the U.S. House. With more on the drug price provisions, we go to Eric Tegedoff.
The U.S. Senate has passed a bill that could dramatically reduce prescription drug prices for older Americans. The Inflation Reduction Act includes investments of nearly $370 billion in programs to reduce the effects of climate change, as well as changes aimed at capping prescription drug costs. Provisions in the bill would allow Medicare to negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies and cap insulin copays at $35 a month for people with Medicare Part D. Kathy McCall with AARP Washington says there are other important parts as well.
It caps out-of-pocket prescription drug prices on Medicare Part D to $2,000 each year, which is going to be a huge financial relief to a lot of older Americans who pay so much more than that for their prescription drugs.
McCall says it would also hold drug companies accountable if they raise prices faster than the rate of inflation. Republicans have condemned the bill, warning that, despite its name, the legislation could exacerbate the country's economic woes. The measure now heads to the U.S. House for a vote. McCall says prescription drugs have been a persistent issue for older Washingtonians. She says one AARP member she spoke with, named John, pays $500 a month for his heart medication.
That's $6,000 a year. $6,000 a year that he is paying just so his heart is healthy enough to help him continue to live. That's outrageous.
McCall believes there's a lot to celebrate in the Inflation Reduction Act, noting that Medicare has been unable to negotiate drug prices for two decades.
Congress is really on the verge of finally bringing prescription drug price relief to seniors. And really, that cannot be underemphasized. This is a historic moment.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report from KBOO's Laura Smith with a look back at the July 9th rally for abortion rights in Washington, D.C. Stick around at 7 for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, there is a chance of isolated thunderstorms and a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 79. Today in history, in 2014, 18-year-old Michael Brown is shot and killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri, sparking the beginning of the Black Lives Matter movement. The quote of the day is from American minister and human rights activist Malcolm X, who said, quote, "You can't separate peace from freedom because no one can be at peace unless he has his freedom." Two Alaska parents have sued a local school district over the use of the phrase "reverence for our creator," and indigenous leaders in the area voiced their frustration. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous leaders in Alaska are voicing frustration after two parents sued Ketchikan School District over the use of tribal values within a local school. The meaning of one value is prompting discussion. KRBD's Reagan Miller has more.
Posted in hallways and classrooms at Ketchikan Charter School are posters listing the 14 Southeast traditional tribal values. One of those values, reverence for our creator, is now at the core of the lawsuit filed by parents Justin Brees and Rebecca King. They are suing Ketchikan School District and Ketchikan Charter School for posting the values in school common areas. Brees says it's a violation of the First Amendment and Alaska's state constitution.
We don't think that the school district should be speaking to any type of spiritual or religious type value. Those type of values are things that are best passed down in a family where your parents teach the students about their religious and spiritual beliefs. And that's not the place of government.
But when Central Council of Thlinkit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson looks at the list, he doesn't see anything exclusive to one religion. He says there's no common religion for indigenous people in Southeast Alaska, and the meaning of reverence for our creator is different for everyone. Peterson says he's open to a conversation about it, but he says a lawsuit is the wrong approach.
It's hard not to feel like this might have some bearings in racism. I don't like to leap to that conclusion, but, you know, it's hard to find when you go down this list of values where we can't all, no matter what our cultural background, find a way to connect to those.
The lawsuit was filed in Ketchikan Superior Court July 25th. Ketchikan's school district has yet to respond in court. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
A man has been arrested in connection with the murder of Jamie Yazzie, a Navajo woman who went missing in 2019. Last week, authorities arrested Tracy James for the alleged murder. Yazzie had been fatally shot and was found on the Hopi Reservation in Arizona in 2021. She was listed as a missing person by tribal and federal authorities. James was indicted on first-degree murder charges and domestic violence charges against three victims between 2018 to 2021, including suffocation, kidnapping, and assault with a dangerous weapon. His detention hearing is scheduled for Tuesday. The U.S. Attorney's Office for Arizona is handling the prosecution. Prosecutors say they're committed to addressing violence in Native communities and addressing issues of missing and murdered Indigenous people, including by working closely with tribes. The Indian Pueblo Cultural Center in New Mexico is commemorating the anniversary of the Pueblo Revolt this week with in-person and virtual events. The Pueblo Revolt, which took place on August 10, 1680, was a successful uprising by Pueblo people against Spanish colonization. The ICC is reflecting on the history with a number of events, including a book club meeting, a lecture, and a yucca knotted cord demonstration. The cord helped Pueblo communities coordinate the timing of the revolt against the Spanish. The native uprising is credited with helping ensure the survival of Pueblo culture. Tribal leaders are set to talk to California state lawmakers in Sacramento on Tuesday about water access and native rights. More than half a dozen leaders are expected to attend a hearing in a joint session by the California Assembly Water Parks and Wildlife Committee and the Native Affairs Committee. Tribal leaders say colonization, the taking of their ancestral lands, and jurisdiction issues have impacted access to adequate water supplies. State and federal officials are also expected to attend the hearing. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Taiwan last week broke with years of tradition and the advice of many experts on U.S.-China relations. Why did she make the trip, and what will come of it? Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. House Leader Nancy Pelosi was intent on visiting Taiwan and did so despite President Biden's misgivings and criticisms from many China experts. The trip might not seem like a big deal to Americans, but these are not ordinary times in U.S.-China relations. That makes a Taiwan trip by a senior person in the U.S. government, in this case the most senior in 25 years, very risky. Prior to her trip, I offered five reasons why I thought the timing and rationale for the trip were wrong. First, U.S.-China tensions over Taiwan are running high. Both sides are responsible for that. President Biden has done his part by consistently misstating the U.S. commitment to Taiwan. There is no security treaty, Mr. President, and by authorizing increased military assistance to Taiwan. To the Chinese, these steps look like a U.S. effort to erode its official policy of One China and move closer to China's red line, Taiwan's independence. Meantime, China's Air Force patrols are more regularly intruding in Taiwan's air defense zone, on occasion causing Taiwan's Air Force to scramble. A military incident that could spark serious fighting becomes more likely with each passing week. Second, Xi Jinping is expected to be given another term as party leader at a National Congress this fall. A high-level trip to Taiwan by a key U.S. political figure in advance of that party Congress could be seen as a personal provocation, particularly since Xi wants to be seen as the leader who will complete China's national unification by recovering Taiwan. He may feel compelled to act. Third, China has already issued warnings of severe consequences if Pelosi goes to Taiwan. We can speculate as to what that might mean, and of course now we know, but Pelosi's trip should not be the occasion for finding out. Fourth, the Ukraine war has led to much speculation about China's intentions regarding Taiwan. Up to now, Xi has reiterated the long-standing Chinese view that peaceful reunification is preferable to war, so long as Taiwan doesn't embrace independence. Pelosi's trip might be viewed in Beijing as the final straw in showing that U.S. policy is abandoning One China. And last, fifth, I wrote, one may question the value of Pelosi's trip. If she's going to Taiwan to show U.S. support, or if she more specifically wants to demonstrate that Democrats are as supportive of Taiwan as Republicans, she can do that at other times. Instead, she did it this time. As she wrote in an op-ed for the Washington Post, quote, in the face of the Chinese Communist Party's accelerating aggression, our congressional delegation's visit should be seen as an unequivocal statement that America stands with Taiwan, our democratic partner, as it defends itself and its freedom, unquote. But no one doubts U.S. support of Taiwan's democracy. The long-standing question is how and whether the U.S. would respond if China were to attack Taiwan, given the official U.S. policy of One China. Pelosi says she supports that principle, but her trip has undermined it by sending China the opposite message, support of Taiwan's separateness. I think the main reason for the trip actually does have to do with our own political situation. Pelosi was trying to show that Democrats can be as tough on China as the Republicans. She was not going to let Republicans take the lead on defending Taiwan, especially after news of a possible trip led several Republican hawks to essentially challenge her to go. So what are the actual consequences of her trip? As she was leaving Taiwan, China began live-fire drills with artillery and missiles very close to Taiwan's shores, and in a few areas inside Taiwan's territorial waters, something China did not do in a previous Taiwan Strait crisis in 1995-1996. Beijing has also imposed trade restrictions and hacked Taiwan government websites, all with promises of more to come. In sum, Pelosi's trip is the stuff of avoidable international crises. putting an opponent to the wall and forcing it to make a choice between a forceful response and a weak one. Xi Jinping, after all, has to deal with his own political situation, in which a show of weakness can be deadly. Her trip was a needless provocation that U.S. allies, which above all prize stability in the Taiwan Strait, do not welcome. Instead, they in Washington must deal with an event that is a serious setback to tension-reducing efforts, such as the Xi-Biden virtual summits. For some time to come, U.S.-China relations will be dogged by the same kind of dynamic that has occurred in three previous confrontations with China over Taiwan, each of which could have escalated to a violent level, and one of which, in 1958, came close to involving U.S. use of nuclear weapons. Pelosi has not done Taiwan a service. She has made its security more precarious. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
Global warming has made unplanned fires even more dangerous. Smokey the Bear still wants you to prevent accidental wildfires. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. August 9th is the birthday of the longest-running public service ad campaign in U.S. history. Since 1944, Smokey Bear has asked Americans to help prevent dangerous wildfires. In the 50s, a live bear rescued from a wildfire in New Mexico became a symbol of the campaign.
This true story of this tiny little bear cub who was abandoned, badly burned,